There have been many loud and sometimes rude detractors of the promotion of the Gaelic language in Scotland. Some say that it was never spoken in such and such region. Now, in some regions, it's true that Gaelic has not been spoken within living memory, and so these kinds of arguments can be somewhat effective. But how true are they? I'm going to trace the linguistic history of Scotland from the Bronze Age all the way to the present. By the end of it, we will have a clear answer for just how Gaelic was Scotland. Usually, I would start such a topic at the beginning, but a few things must be said before we rewind into prehistoric time. Gaelic was and is an important language in Scottish history. While Scottish Gaelic is spoken by probably less than 2% of the population in Scotland today, when the country was established, it was the first language of its kings, and it was spoken across almost all of Scotland. It is for this reason that Scotland is called the Land of the Scots. Bavalam dunya vrosnachug gu iunsachug is klechtachug a chanan. Scot was an archaic ethnonym used during the Roman period to refer to the Gaelic population. It's probably related to the Gaelic word scoth, coming from Proto-Celtic scuta, meaning the edge of a blade. Likely, it was used to refer to ancient Gaelic war bands who were similar in nature to later Vikings. The name Gael itself was borrowed into the language from Brythonic, Gwydel, meaning wild man. Effectively, the word Gael means barbarian, and it was embraced warmly and actually became the primary way that they referred to themselves. Now, it's generally thought that these raiders also brought Gaelic to Scotland sometime during the Roman period, but the situation is far more complex than this. To get a real understanding of it, we need to rewind about 4,400 years. Alba is the Gaelic name for Scotland, but it originally referred to all of Britain, coming from an earlier Proto-Celtic Albiu, meaning the bright land, referring to the land under the sun, the land of the living world. It's cognate with Welsh Elfith, meaning world, earth, and similar in meaning to Proto-Slavic Svet, meaning light and also world. Its Indo-European cognates can be found across Europe, the Alps, Alban Hills near Rome, Albania. Now, following the Chalcolithic settlement of Britain by the Belbeker population from Central Europe, Britain would have transitioned to speaking a dialect of Proto-Indo-European ancestral to Celtic and Italic language families. The Neolithic inhabitants in much of Britain were largely replaced along with their languages. Their population contributed to perhaps less than 10% of the later Bronze Age British and Irish populations. Now, this transition, however, was slower in some northern regions of Scotland, especially Orkney, where Neolithic male lineages continued to be dominant for another 1,000 years, until gradually blending into the broader late Bronze Age Scottish gene pool. In Orkney, the Neolithic population maintained themselves as a politically and ethnically distinct population, resisting initial Belbeker settlement. But over time, they gradually intermarried, with genetic studies showing an increased Belbeker female lineage, which would correspond to typical marriage practices between allied groups. Likely, a Neolithic language survived here the longest of anywhere in Britain, but it didn't survive into the historical period, and probably not even into the Iron Age, although that is less certain. In the late Bronze Age, a new population begins to move into the south of Britain. Connection between Britain and the mainland had never really stopped, and Britain was playing a large role in the continental tin and bronze trade, but between 1100 and 800 BC, there was a much greater influx from the continent. These were the proto-Celts of the Urnfield culture, who were likewise spreading throughout Central and Western Europe. It's believed that they were responsible for the Celticization of Britain and Ireland. A recent study has shown that in southwestern England, the Iron Age population had a 55% continental admixture. In south central England, 56%, and in the southeast, 52%. In South Wales, there was a 53%. Yet, these figures are strongly regional. So, for instance, in North Wales, the admixture was only 22%. In Cornwall, 39%, the Midlands, 36%, and the North, 35%. In Scotland, the results appear far lower. In the west of Scotland, samples show as little as 8% continental admixture, while in eastern Scotland, the numbers rise to around 16%. The highest is, perhaps surprisingly, in Orkney, where it was around 20%. Due to this lower Central European Celtic admixture, Scotland also has some of the highest amounts of steppe ancestry in Britain. Now, the reason for this is because of lower levels of late Bronze Age continental migration, as these mainland Celts were far more mixed with early farmer populations in Central Europe than Bronze Age Britons were. Language does not always correspond to genetics, of course. Many countries speak other languages through the cultural effects of military conquest and the installation of another elite class. In the case of Scotland and Ireland, it is likely that the relatively small bands of mainland Celts were able to seize political control and, coupled with cultural and economic dominance in the region and with similarities of the language derived from the same root, the early Balbeaker dialects of Britain and Ireland were absorbed into the Celtic linguistic sphere. Probably during the early Iron Age, the language of Proto-Celtic in Britain and Ireland would undergo local changes that would give rise to the branch of Celtic known as Insular Celtic. It has various grammatical differences with mainland Celtic languages. One is the favoring of a VSO word order. Now, perhaps around 600 BC, a linguistic split begins to emerge very slowly at first in Britain and Ireland. While Proto-Celtic had no developed P sound, some tribes begin to shift the initial Proto-Celtic qu sound to a p sound, while others did not. Though they would eventually reduce the qu to a k, the go-to example for this change is the word for head, pen in Brythonic, but quen in Proto-Gaelic, or ken in Old Gaelic. This is why some refer to the language split as Q versus P Celtic, although the language groups are more specifically divided into Brythonic, which uses P Celtic forms, and Goidelic, which uses Q and then K forms. Now, the sound change may not represent another wave of Celtic migration, but follows from linguistic contact and internal evolution. In some places in Iberia, for instance, P and Q forms are found in close proximity to each other, possibly suggesting that one tribe had become P Celtic, while another had become Q Celtic. It's quite possible that such a scenario played out in Scotland as well, perhaps in part separated by mountains, rivers, lochs, and highlands. though the minor sound differences alone wouldn't have made the languages unintelligible, it would gradually be accompanied by an ever-widening gulf in vocabulary and grammar. Those in southern Britain would be highly influenced by Gaulish, while those in the north and in Ireland, far less so. By the Roman era, the Brythonic and Goidelic languages are very unlikely to have had any significant mutual intelligibility beyond some shared vocabulary, and by 600 AD, they were more different from each other than, say, Bulgarian from Russian, with only an estimated 30 to 40% lexical overlap. This represents a huge linguistic divergence that occurred over 1,000 years. By the early Iron Age, everyone in Scotland would have been speaking a Proto-Indo-European-derived language, but it is possible that not all of them were speaking a form of Proto-Celtic. The lowlands and the east coast were prime regions. Celtic warbands would have sought to gain the most productive lands, and these places were most likely the ones Celticized first. From around 500 BC, Common Brythonic would have been spoken across England and at least South Wales. It was spoken among the east coast of northern England. The Brythonic presence in southern Scotland, the border regions, Lanarkshire and Lothian, could represent a northward expansion of Brythonic groups afterwards, which explains why the limit of Common Brythonic appears to stop dead at the River Forth, a geographically and likely militarily defended boundary, which saw the tribes north of it able to prevent further northward expansion of southern tribes. Yet in the highlands and islands in the west, we actually don't really have a firm grasp of what the linguistic situation was like. The earliest history which implies Gaelic presence in Scotland can be found in a document called the Latruculus Veronensis, written around 314. It details a list of so-called barbarian tribes along the entire Roman frontier, running from west to east. Now, it begins with Scoti, Picti, Caledoni. This is not only the earliest evidence for Goidelic speakers in Scotland, but it also is the earliest surviving use of the term Scoti. The choice to use this new ethnic identifier rather than the earlier Eberni is likely to differentiate these Goidelic speakers who dwelt in Scotland along the Roman frontier from those who lived in Ireland, though they would soon be used interchangeably. Yet, in the earliest Gaelic sources, Irish never refer to themselves as Scoti, except in Latin, showing that it was not a native ethnonym, but was instead a term that was used by those who had settled in regions of Scotland. Now, another early account is from Roman historian Ammianus Marcellinus, writing around 390 AD, about events that took place around 360. He said, "But in Britain, in the 10th consulship of Constantius, and the 3rd of Julian, raids of the savage tribes of the Scots and the Picts, who had broken the peace that had been agreed upon, were laying waste to the regions near the frontiers, so that fear seized the provincials." Now, if the Scots were only coming across the sea from Ireland at that time, why would they have focused their attacks on a defended border rather than any undefended area on the massive British coastline? And we know that Gaels from Ireland were establishing settlements in what is now Wales and Cornwall, but these raids in the north often imply a geographical proximity. Claudian, writing in De Bello Gothico, said, "Next, the legion that had been left to guard Britain, the legion that kept the fierce Scots in check, whose men had scanned the strange devices tattooed on the faces of the dying Picts." Now, some of these early accounts of the Picts and Scots also include a third group, the Atacoti. Some earlier scholars link the name to the Old Gaelic Athach Tuath, rent-paying tribes. Etymologically, this doesn't appear to work, but the first part may indeed be cognate with the Old Gaelic Athach. So Atach Scoti, for instance, may possibly become Atacoti. That would make them a tribe who served the Scoti High King. Though, of course, this is all very speculative. Paulus Orosius, a Christian historian from Braga, Portugal, writing in probably around 415 AD, said, "Close to Ireland is the island of Mevania, itself not small in size and well provided with soil. It likewise is inhabited by tribes of the Scoti." Now, this marks the first historical confirmation that Goidelic speakers inhabited the island of Man. Yet, if Goidelic speakers occupied Man at that time, it's logical to assume that they also occupied at least the coastal regions of places like Galloway, and certainly places like Kintyre, Arran, and Islay, all of which lay closer to Ireland than Man does. The writings of Gildas, perhaps around 550 AD, are our earliest direct source for British history written by a Briton. Now, speaking of the Roman abandonment of Britain, he says, "Completely ignorant of the practices of war, she is, for the first time, open to be trampled upon by two foreign tribes of extreme cruelty, the Scots from the northwest, the Picts from the north." Now, Gildas places the Gaels along the west coast of Scotland and is describing them overrunning the northern British tribes of what is now southern Scotland and northern Britain. That at least by the time of his writing, Gaels had occupied Argyll and quite possibly other western areas in Scotland and had been settled there for long enough that even in 550, they were thought to have long resided there. In around 150 AD, the ancient Greco-Roman geographer Claudius Ptolemy created a map of Britain and Ireland, which included names of tribes, towns, fortified settlements, and also some river names. According to his map, the region, which since the early medieval period has been known as Argyll, meaning the land of the Gaels, was inhabited by a people called the Epidi. This is a P-Celtic form of the Goidelic name Echidh, such as the Gaelic god known in Old Gaelic as Echidh Ol-Athir. However, Ptolemy likely obtained the name through a Brythonic-speaking source, who may have provided the corresponding name in his own language. Ulster Gaelic legend records a certain Echidh Echbel, horseman Horsemouth, ruling in the region of Argyll at the time of Conchobar Mac Nessa, contemporary with Jesus Christ. In the Book of Leinster, it says, "The High Olaf of Ireland sent his son Nede to study in Scotland under Echidh Echbel, who lived in Kintyre," exactly the region where Ptolemy's map shows the Epidi. When traveling back to Ireland, he first travels to locations in Ayrshire and Galloway. Ptolemy's map also seems to call the island of Islay Epidium, which may indicate the same tribe was living there. Now, many of the islands that appear on the map are hard to place, given that Scotland is incorrectly tipped towards the east. However, the island identified as Maleos appears to correspond to the island of Mull, the name coming from Proto-Celtic Mylos, meaning bear, bald, and is used in Gaelic for names of promontories, so the Mull of Kintyre can be translated as the promontory of the headland. The island on Ptolemy's map named Monoeoda corresponds to what is later called Manavia, the island of man, derived from the Brythonic Monith. Now, some of the islands in the Outer Hebrides were identified on the map as Ebuda, from which the English name Hebrides is derived. Now, some have theorized that the name is pre-Celtic, very likely pre-Celtic Indo-European, which is a real possibility. The name appears in old Gaelic texts as Ibdone and Ibdan. According to the Hagiography of St. Canach, written between 750 and 850 AD, the saint traveled to the island of Ibdane as a guest. He drove all the mice into the sea in revenge for them having chewed his shoes. The island is widely agreed by Gaelic scholars to be Uisht. St. Canach of Agaboa is one of the so-called 12 Apostles of Ireland, very early saints who are credited with spreading Christianity throughout Ireland and Scotland, all through the Highlands and Islands, establishing churches and monastic cells, including on Ibdan and Tiree. It isn't suggested that he ever encountered people that he was unable to converse with. In fact, that he was invited as a guest to Uisht very much suggests that the island was inhabited by Gaelic speakers, at least as of the 500s AD. The name, though, may very well be pre-Celtic in origin. Even very common words, such as guigh, meaning wind, comes from the pre-Celtic Indo-European language that was once spoken across Britain and Ireland, but is preserved now only in Gaelic. Now, in Gaelic, ibdach is also a word that's used for a specific kind of barley, seemingly a variety which was grown in the Hebrides. Archaeological studies have actually confirmed that barley production in the Hebrides was very massive in the Iron Age, and even in recent history, the islands were known to produce it. Now, the Gaels were the least genetically influenced by mainland Celtic migration, and so we can expect to likewise see preserved the most pre-Celtic insular Indo-European vocabulary. That pre-Celtic language is not well understood and is a very ancient branch dating to 2500 BC and the first Balbeakers to settle Britain and Ireland. Some place names on Ptolemy's map are Brythonic forms. The Selgovi had a town called Uxellum. This corresponds to the Brythonic form Uchel, modern Welsh Ichel, meaning high. The Gaelic cognate is Uasal. However, there are other names which are absolutely not Brythonic. One of these names is a Smertai. Brythonic reduced all the initial SM and SN consonant clusters. So, though we see names like Smertios in Gaul, a warrior god sometimes identified with Mars, such a name would be rendered Mertios in Brythonic. In Gaelic, the word smer can mean berries. There is also smir, which can mean like bone marrow, and smirda, of the marrow, and smenta, spinal cord. The Smertai were either Goidelic or another non-Brythonic branch of Celtic or Indo-European. From the west coast of England, there is one tribe which I have to mention, the Setanti. The name is certainly cognate with the original name of the Gaelic champion Cuchulainn, Setanta. The tribe may have referred to themselves as his son, even as he was the son of the god Lugus. Whether they were Brythonic or Goidelic, it reinforces the common origins of both people. English historian Bede, writing between 701 and 735, recalled a legend regarding the Dal Riadans, which said they had been led by their leader, Riada, from whom they were named. Now, this would fit into the regular pattern of Gaelic legendary history, which is always presented as an unfolding of various migrations and settlements. However, it makes it no more historically accurate than the story of the Milesians settling Ireland after their long journey from Scythia to Spain, and the similar story of Pictish origins. Yet, he provides some details about the historical settlement locations of Gaels Hereupon they suffered many years from the sudden invasions of two very savage nations from beyond the sea, the Scots from the west and the Picts from the north. We call these nations from beyond the sea, not on account of their being seated out of Britain, but because they were separated from that part of it which was possessed by the Britons, two broad and long inlets of sea lying between them, one of which runs into the interior of Britain from the eastern sea, and the other from the western, though they do not reach so far as to touch one another. The eastern has in the midst of it the city of Gudi, on the western sea, that is. On its right shore stands the city of Alt Cluith, which in their language signifies the rock Cluith, for it is close to the river of that name. So Bede believed that the Gaels were present in Dal Riada, at least from the Roman period, if not earlier. Further, speaking of English conquests in 603, he states, "For Ethelfrith conquered more territories from the Britons than any other chieftain or king, either subduing the inhabitants and making them tributary, or driving them out and planting the English in their places. Hereupon, Eadhun, king of the Scots that dwell in Britain, being alarmed by his successes, came against him with a great and mighty army, but was defeated and fled with a few followers. For almost all of his army was cut to pieces in a famous place called Degsastan, that is, Degsa's Stone. From that time, no king of the Scots durst come into Britain to make war on the English to this day." Now, while it can be demonstrated that Gaelic was anciently present in Scotland, likely from the time of the very origins of the language group itself, in the early Middle Ages between 500 and 800 AD, Gaelic was not the majority language of Scotland. Pictish was still dominant in the east, and Brythonic south of the Forth. English had also gained a strong foothold in the southeast, especially following the defeat of the Brythonic kingdom of Gododdin, including what is now Edinburgh around 638. However, the Gaels were experiencing a rapid expansion, both in their numbers and in their cultural influence. It was predominantly Scottish monks and missionaries who were converting much of Scotland to Christianity. And through this religious dominance, they were likewise gaining ethnic and political clout. English kings, especially those in the north, sometimes learned Gaelic, and during this period, the Gaelic language was probably the most written language in Europe besides Latin and Greek, though much of the earliest writings don't survive, having been destroyed in Viking raids. The Gaelic culture was vibrant and powerful, and would contribute to the spread of the Gaelic language. Now, though the Kingdom of Strathclyde was a predominantly Brythonic kingdom, Gaelic was likely already spreading in the west of Ayrshire and Galloway prior to 800 AD. In Galloway especially, the language must have been very anciently rooted there. Their dialect of the language was actually quite divergent from others found in Scotland, but also divergent from those found in Ireland. This would indicate a long period of linguistic isolation there. In Cumberland, especially around Carlisle, there are also numerous places of Gaelic origin, intermixed with Brythonic, English, and Old Norse names, such as Dundrar, Drumlenning, Durdar, from Gaelic Derdar, meaning oak grove, Carrick, from the Gaelic for stone. Even as far as the region of Westmoreland, we find Knock, from Gaelic Knock, meaning hill. Now, sometimes a fusion of Gaelic and Norse, such as Torquay, possibly a Gaelicization of Thor's head, or else Tor, meaning a point, not far from Thorsby. Now, not all of these place names will be of ancient origin, but they do signify Gaelic presence in northern England. The Gaelic-Norse fusion also might suggest that the Gaelic settlements predate the arrival of the Norse in the region, who appropriated local names and fused them with their own. Now, there has been a lot of debate about the nature and exact geographical region of the Pictish language, but likely a majority of those north of the Forth on the east side of Scotland spoke Pictish in around the 5th century AD. Pictish given names often appear divided between those similar to Brythonic and those similar to Goidelic, Drust being cognate with Welsh Drist, while Urgust is cognate with Gaelic Fergus. The ultimate proximity between Picts and Gaels is explained in various old Irish tales, the oldest of which dates prior to 700 AD and depicts the Cruthani as being cousins of the Gaels, intermarried with Gaelic women, and distinct from the Britons. Despite the fact that Cruthen and Priden, the original word Briton is based on, are actually cognate, meaning he who fashions. This may indicate a much older origin for the story than simply the Pictish period. It could be that the Gaelic story is a dim reflection of the Celtic conquest of Britain and Ireland. Such histories would have been preserved by bards and druids who were trained to memorize such tales from a very young age and performed to praise the kings who descended from them. The idea that the Gaels and the Picts were both closely related invading peoples from the continent could be a genuine fragment of the history of the Celtic warrior aristocracy that gained power in the end of the Bronze Age, preserved in the legends of the people. Drum Alban, meaning the spine of Alba, is mentioned in old Gaelic tales. It was used to signify, in an early period, the approximate political boundaries between the Gaels and the Picts. It's likely that since the Bronze Age, the mountains and lochs acted to separate East and West Scotland, and at the same time, the sea acted as a roadway between Western Scotland and Ireland, most likely forming a linguistic continuum that stretched through to southern Ireland, and perhaps as far north as the islands of the Ebuda, with the northern islands being distant, remote, strange, yet ultimately part of the Gaelic world. Figures like Cuchulainn and Conall Cearnach frequently venture into Scotland, the land of the goddess Scathach, who trains Cuchulainn, is located in the highlands of Scotland. As an actual goddess, she is known as Buanan in Cormac's glossary and equated with the Roman goddess Minerva. Now, that Gaelic gods were believed to be even living in Scotland clearly identifies the territory as being part of the Gaelic world. Likely, much of the west coast was speaking a form of Goidelic by the late Iron Age. And this linguistic continuum would, at the furthest end, begin to blend into Pictish. By 800 AD, the Picts appear to have been highly integrated with the Gaels. They were Christianized by them, they were using their writing system, and very likely they, or at least the elite, were largely bilingual in Gaelic and Pictish. By 839, the Pictish elite were so heavily integrated into the Gaelic elite that when Uinn, son of Unist, king of the Picts, fell in battle against the Vikings, Aeth, king of Dal Riada, fell at his side. It's likely that Cinéad mac Alpin was at least part Pictish, and after the destruction of the Pictish elite in 839, he was the legitimate inheritor of the Pictish crown. Cinéad was a relatively common name for Pictish kings. In any case, the rise of Cinéad and the blurred lines between his Gaelic and Pictish identity show that the Picts were increasingly becoming Gaelicized. The last king of the Picts was Donal, son of Causatine, son of Kinnaeth, who died in 900 AD. After this, their independent identity quickly faded away. Genetic studies, however, show that regional genetic clusters, including what could be called a Pictish cluster in the northeast, though the Pictish elite had been destroyed and eventually their language and ethnic identity abandoned, the population didn't go anywhere. While Gaelic-speaking settlement in Pictish regions was part of the spread of the language, it wasn't the complete or even the primary driver. The Picts didn't disappear. They became Gaels. By 950 AD, nearly everyone north of the Forth and Clyde Canal was speaking Gaelic. The Book of Deer was written in Deer, Aberdeenshire, between the 10th and 12th century, and contains the earliest verifiable Gaelic written in Scotland, in what is now considered to be a lowland Scot stronghold. However, in the south, there were still speakers of Cumbric, a language very closely related to Old Welsh, in the Brythonic-speaking kingdom of Strathclyde. When Scotland absorbed the kingdom of Strathclyde, there was an additional influx into the area of Gaelic speakers, and likely some degree of bilingualism also. Though the region of Lanarkshire did not become heavily Gaelicized, there are numerous place names that show a Gaelic influence in the area. And while Pictish was replaced by Gaelic, there was a tug of war for the Brythonic regions between the English in the east and the Gaels in the west and north. The English would establish a significant language presence in what is now the southeast of Scotland. When the Kingdom of Scotland conquered Lothian from the Northumbrian English in 1018, the region would see some Gaelic settlement, but due to a number of factors, Gaelic did not spread here to any significant degree. This became the base for Old English, yet the spread of English throughout wider Scotland was by no means something fated to happen. In 1100 AD, the Gaelic language seemed like a powerhouse, and culturally it had massive reach. It was the height of the Middle Gaelic linguistic period, which was awash with literature, both religious and secular. Gaelic scholars were fluent in ancient Greek and Latin, and they were translating those works into medieval Gaelic, as well as writing native tales. Bards were abound, becoming so popular that their skills penetrated into the English world, so that we still call this group of people using the Gaelic name rather than the original Old English one. Gaelic saints, priests, and monks became famous and well-respected, not only in Wales and England, but in France and Germany, where there were numerous communities paying devotion to Gaelic saints. Many words from Middle Gaelic made their way into English. Far more Gaelic words exist in English than, for instance, Brythonic ones, and ones even in frequent use, like slogan, galore, clan, glen, plaid, loch, banshee, smithereen, slough, and others. But then a series of political events would align to dramatically change the course of what was a rising language of high European culture and education. The first blow was the Anglo-Norman invasion of Ireland. The second, and the most deadly, subtle strike, however, came from within. It was the axe of King David I of Scotland. He was the son of Malcolm III, but his mother, Margaret of Wessex, was the far greater influence upon him. He spent some years in exile with his relatives in England, and when they helped him gain the throne, he changed everything. A Middle Gaelic poem laments, "Olc and Darna MacMail Colum, Ar Coseth Rick Alexander Doni Legach Machri Roman, Fogel Ar Faras Alban." When he had gained power in much of Scotland, David implemented a host of Norman-inspired changes. Most significantly, traitorously, he invited Normans to come and rule over the native Scottish population. He established royal boroughs, Berwick, Edinburgh, Stirling, Perth, Aberdeen, which were afforded special laws and to which English, Normans, and Flemish were invited to migrate to in massive numbers. The Anglo-Normans established commercial centers with financial power that conducted all their business and laws in a mix of Norman and English. Ethnic migration was at the root of the later linguistic reshaping of the country. These towns became centers of the spread of what became Scots, which in the modern period gave way to Standard English. These changes and more brought about by David between 1124 and 1153 are known now as the Davidian Revolution, due to their sweeping and dramatic effects on the kingdom. Before David, Scotland was administered by a traditional Gaelic society with Gaelic law. After David, it was the worst of medieval Norman feudalism, with Anglo-Normans in control of the core centers of power and wealth. Before David, Gaelic had reached its high water mark, being the common vernacular of the large majority of Scotland. But after David, it would begin to recede, but much slower, perhaps, than many people think. Somerled was establishing a powerful dynasty in the Western Isles, rooted in a cultural fusion of Norse and Gael, which would, for several hundred years, serve to counter this linguistic pressure from the East due to its attachment and promotion of the Gaelic language and traditional Bardic culture. Coupled with the geographical and economic isolation in Western Scotland, the same reasons why the region was likely not part of the Brythonic or Pictish language community, it would remain Gaelic for longer. In 1300, Galloway and South Ayrshire were still vastly Gaelic-speaking, but the boroughs such as Ayr, Dumfries, were already becoming Scots. While the eastern Grampian glens were still Gaelic, Scots had taken root in coastal towns like Aberdeen and Dundee. A similar dynamic was unfolding around Perthshire, where the countryside was vastly Gaelic, but the town itself was increasingly Scots. The rural-urban linguistic divide would remain for a long time. One reason for the slowness of the process is because at that time, the towns did not have the same economic power and importance that they would later possess. When the economy was still largely based on agriculture and the vast majority lived off the land, Gaelic speakers could maintain their communities in relative isolation. Though the city of Aberdeen was primarily Scots, there were still many Gaelic-speaking communities, especially in the Upper Deeside area of Aberdeenshire. Banchory was, in 1700, a predominantly Gaelic-speaking community with their own dialect known as Deeside Gaelic. The last native speaker died as late as 1984 to give some idea of the longevity of the language in the Northeast. In rural Perthshire, Gaelic remained the majority language until the early 18th century as well. Now, in the South, the process was unfolding more rapidly. By the early 1700s, Gaelic had disappeared in most Ayrshire and was quickly fading in Galloway also. Yet it was the dramatic changes in the 18th and 19th century that would see the language's sudden and dramatic decline. The clearances, coupled with industrialization, forced or pulled many Gaelic speakers from their traditional lifestyles, their communities, into the cities. Cities where the language was a minority and where its use was strongly discouraged. Though some worked to keep it alive, many others actively tried to leave it behind, seeing it as a burden of the past, a barrier to the betterment of their family. The establishment of formal state-run education, conducted only in English, sped up this process dramatically. However, there was another important factor: emigration. Rather than move to cities in Scotland or England for work, many Gaels decided to migrate to the New World, settling primarily in Canada and the United States. Hundreds of thousands of Gaelic speakers from the Highlands and Islands would make the journey. In some places in North America, they established Gaelic-speaking communities, and many regions are awash with Gaelic place names due to settlers naming the areas after their homeland. This exodus of Gaels from Scotland had a dramatic effect on the language continuity and increased the overall English population percentage in the country, similar to the effect of the Irish famine and migration on the Irish language. By 1800, the people who spoke Gaelic made up only around 20% of the overall population, and by 1880, that had fallen to only 6%. More would have identified as Gaels despite losing their language. The current percentage of speakers of Gaelic in Scotland is only around 1.4%. More migrants move to Scotland every year than there are total Gaelic speakers. So how Gaelic was Scotland? Well, it was once very Gaelic, more Gaelic perhaps than some Lowlanders would want to admit. Yet the dominance of English in many of the most populated areas has long been a reality, and it's likewise a part of the national character of Scotland today. Fahu na grainne, stad enslaved you, an cran darich ard, volag leis avard, chanel uske ach hon fair, is e ri na slug, dorain e a Gaelic.